But what the heck's your source for Warhammer Underworlds in under 30 vague silhouettes of random figures coming up in the next season or less? I'm Davey. I'm with you always, and with me as usual is Phil. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm doing all right.
And with us tonight, we have a special guest. This is Jeff Osborne coming in. How are you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. We're glad to have you. We're going to get you a little bit of intro in a second here. But before we get started, we'd like to always give you the context. We're coming to you right after the first teaser of Beastgrave. And that means that we've had the most recent banned and restricted list and all the associated frequently asked questions was the June 2019 one. So that, if you're not sure, that was when Tome of Offerings and something else got added.
Long Strider.
Yes. Thank you, Phil. So that's where we stand right now. We're still waiting on the release of Dreadfane. And, of course, now that we know the name, Beastgrave is inbound. We always like to start out with thanks to the folks who reached out. You can get us at WTHcast or whatthehexcast@gmail.com. Tom Merrigan's been leaving some nice messages for us on Facebook. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate the feedback. And then here's a real easy name to say, JDCS7Y. I think that's on his birth certificate. Dropped us a review on Podbean. And we've been getting some ratings on Apple Podcasts and all that sort of thing. Very much thank you for that. We'll hit that back up. I have some personal thanks, and it's going to break my heart because I'm going to forget some people here, and I'll try and get you in another episode if I don't. But Brandon, Taylor Huss, Zach Newcomb, Mark Cooper, Matthew Martin, Brendan of the Magnificent Mustache, Josh Miller times two, the whole Bills crew, Josh from my round four, I don't know what your name was, but all you fellas, you were great. I'm glad to have gotten a chance to play it, and we'll get a little more into that, into what we've been doing. And our other lead-off, we got community shout-outs. I would like to give a shout-out to No Gits, No Glory. It's a new blog. I think they're on their third or fourth episode. And it is an entirely Zarbag's Gits-related blog, which is, man, shout-out to this guy who is covering them. He's got a great writing style. He's real funny. He's real intelligent with what he's putting down on the blog. I recommend you go read it, even if you're not, even if Gits is not your blog of choice. I don't know. Have you guys gotten a chance to read it yet, Phil or Jeff?
I have not, but I mean to, because Gits is a list that I just look at and kind of just throw my hands in the air and go, I don't know what to do with this. So definitely looking to pick up some pointers there.
Sure. How about you, Jeff?
Yeah, I saw he was posting in the Underworlds Facebook group that the new posts were up. I did click on them. I read a little bit of it. I'm not a Gits player specifically, but I did like, as you mentioned, his writing style. I think it's really creative. I wish him all the best as we go into season three, when maybe the Gits might be in under a little bit more pressure to come out.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I played a little bit of Gits in my time, and as I'm playing them, I throw my hands up in the air and say, what am I doing? But they're a fun warband, and I like his take on it, and I hope he can find the energy to keep it going, because his writing style is excellent. So hats off. If you haven't checked it, we'll have a link to the blog itself in the show notes. If you try to Google it, you're going to have a hard time. I've actually had to use, shout out to Wigglehammer. I tried Googling it, couldn't find it, went to Wigglehammer's helpful links, and there it was. So Jonathan Davis, you're a prince. Thank you for what you do.
Scholar and a gentleman.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I had the pleasure of playing on his team, and I'll get back to that. But anybody else got any community shout outs they want to throw out here before we move along?
I think I'll just probably say hello to all the Canadians out there. I'm a Canadian myself from the Greater Toronto area, so just a little shout out to the Hexaholics in the Durham region and everybody who plays in the Greater GTA.
Yeah, salute to Canadian crits who I got to see. They are from London, Ontario, so you probably know those madmen who drove all the way down to Chattanooga.
That's commitment.
Yeah. All right, and our segment that we call What the Hex is Going On With You, we ask what is going on with our folks, and we're going to lead it off with Jeff, but before I do that, I just want to say we brought Jeff on here Jeff is the Skaven player who is the, I'm going to say, underreported hero of Adepticon 2019, who went undefeated with his Skaven, taking down multiple Molochs on the way. Jeff basically button-hooked me as I was headed to the bathroom, and that was pretty much the story of my last weekend, was on my way to or from the water fountain or bathroom, running into Jeff and then chatting real quick with him about what was going on. And I remember talking to him and being like, man, this dude can hold a conversation. I want this guy on the podcast. And so here he is, mission accomplished. But Jeff, what have you been up to lately in Warhammer Underworlds? Let us know.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate that little shout out there. Down in the ATC, I bumped into you. I was down there for the ATC 40K event. I wish I had known about the Underworlds when I had signed up. I've been going to the ATC down there for a few years for 40K. So next year, Underworlds it is. But what I've been up to from a hobby perspective is that I'm working on my converted Godsworn warband. They're now like a two-tone prime. I did, I think, a good conversion on them. I posted on the Underworlds Facebook group. And just really excited to kind of get a chance to, there's the Golden Demon version of cards every time there's a tournament pack that comes out. And the Q4 one is Great Fortitude. Sometimes the Golden Demon card you'd never use in a deck. And finally there's one. Last time was Great Strength. This one's Great Fortitude. And so I really want to get it. So I'm going to paint those Godsworn up really well, I think.
Excellent. You're saying you're not using Great Cunning in your current deck?
Not currently. No, I'm not. Season 3. You never know. Everything gets new context then. And then from a gaming perspective, I'm really retooling my Skaven deck that I took to Adepticon, trying to get in some new tech that I saw. And it was inspired from the Wigglehammer article for Fester and Hunger. I think it was Mad Skills that had done that article, and it was just really well done. He talked through so much detail on it that I really wanted to take some of the tech that he's been using for kind of a denial type build and bring that into my current Skaven deck, which is very much a control build. So I'm really looking forward to taking that through the Q4 gauntlet starting later this month.
Very nice.
Sounds excellent. Yeah. I think we technically have not shouted out that article yet. That's yet to come. We have a little bit of a temporal anomaly here. That's because of the subject we're looking to cover tonight. We're a fan of that series as well. And shout out preemptively to Matt Skulls. You're going to get another one here when time catches up to our recordings, basically.
Yeah.
Phil, what have you been up to?
Oh, been working in our local league, getting more people to join up. We've, over the course of about 10 weeks, built up from 3 consistent players to about 16. So really feeling good about getting a community built here to get some pretty regular gaming in, which is super nice. And beyond that, I've really been trying to figure out how to crack Eyes of the Nine. And it's been a struggle, but
keep trying, because my win rate is just loving it.
Yeah. I'm sure. Yeah. But you know, I'll just keep messing with it. I figure at some point, you know, you figure something out that works eventually, and it'll catch everyone off guard.
Yeah. I joke about that, but the only reason I'm not trying Eyes of the Nine is that because you are trying them so much, and mirror matches are a little much. I like their room for creativity that they got.
For sure.
For myself, I have done a whole bunch. I went down to the American Team Championships in Chattanooga. I had the honor of being asked to join the Path to Glory team, and we well represented, so we took that home for the first time. It was the first I can't remember. It's not Grand Clash. It's a Grand Battle, I think, is how what they describe their team events as. That was cool. If you want to hear more about that, I guested on a Path to Glory episode that just released this past week. So go check that out. The following day, I got to play in the singles event. They had they're going to call it a Grand Skirmish, and I think you're going to see a lot more of those in years to come. They're looking to formalize some of their different formats. So Grand Clash, Grand Paddle, Grand Skirmish. Grand Skirmish was a 5-round event, best of one as it went. I brought the Godsworn Hunt and demonstrated that I had not practiced with them nearly as much as I had with the control monologue that I took to the American Championship. I went 2-3. Every one of my games was, I think, I may be wrong, but it was decided by 2 glory points. I had the honor of being defeated by a father and son in not quite consecutive rounds, but both Brandon and Taylor Huss took me down in round 3 and round 5. They were great games. I had a good time. And then Phil and I, we ran a little event ourselves here, and we got to run even more. I ran even more Godsworn. Phil ran Eyes, to his detriment, I guess.
yeah,
you're almost there. you got your comeuppance by running Reavers at me, which I've decided that is a rough matchup for Godsworn, and I want to crack that code. So more reps to be TBD here. But I'm loving the game, and I'm loving it even more because we got new stuff on the way. Our episode tonight, we're bringing you there's been a sneak preview, or not sneak preview, I guess I'd say a teaser of the Season 3 release, and we thought this would be a good opportunity to take a look back at Season 2, look at Night Vault, and see what it brought us. So what you're going to be getting us from tonight is the Beastgrave, the sneak preview, the teaser, and what our takeaways from that spoiler is, and we're going to do Night Vault retrospective, so we'll go over that as well. Special note, I know on our last episode we said we'd be coming at you with rules of thumb. That's still coming your way. We're just going to roll it back, and you'll be seeing it come up, so put that on hold, coming your way soon. All right, Beastgrave, that is Season 3. Here it comes. So we got from the open day, the spoiler, drop that video, Beastgrave. We're going to be talking about that now. So let's kick it off. We saw a little video. Jeff, putting you on the spot here a little bit, but...
yeah, by all means.
All right. So we saw the video. It is like 30-second teaser and then a couple images, like stills pulled away. Based on what people saw, and if somehow you haven't seen this, we'll put the link in the show notes, but based on what you saw, what factions are you expecting?
At this point in time, I'm expecting Wanderers and Beastmen.
Okay.
I think that's, looking at the silhouettes, kind of bringing out the CSI in me, I've been overlaying things, I'm pretty sure it's Wanderers and Beastmen, but, you know, that's GW, it could be anything.
So give me the why on Wanderers.
The Wanderers, they have some kits that are already released of riders on stags where they have antlers. There's one of the stills looking through the trees. You can see that there's somebody riding something, and they have clear stag horns coming out of their helm area. So I think that's what's going on there. And then the Beastmen, it's only a single still or outline that they show, but I think it's, since we're in the Beast Grave, I think the Beastmen are probably going to be there, and that axe that he's holding kind of has that look to it. So I think that's why we're going that direction. The internet is full of speculation at this point
about
these two orbiting. Yeah, as it should be. Yeah, it gets a lot of communication going, which I think is great, gets the community involved. But my guess for the opening box, or the box set that's going to be coming out, is Wanderers and Beastmen.
Fair. Phil, how do you feel about that prediction?
I would generally agree. I kind of almost wonder if Wanderers is like, if they're setting us up to think Wanderers. Mm-hmm. It just feels like the kind of thing that they might do, to be like, oh, this looks so much like an elf, and maybe it'll just be some like Gur humans or something, and it'll be something crazy. I'm guessing that's where this lion comes in, is probably to go along with whatever the not Beastmen people were. Mm-hmm. That's my guess anyway. And as to the Beastmen, I'm not really sure what part of Beastmen it is, but I'm kind of wondering if it's Centaurs and it's going to be all Centaurs. And I'm actually wondering if it's not a Wild Rider, but just a very different type of Centaur look. They gave them horns and stuff.
For people not well versed in the Warhammer or Age of Sigmar background, a Centaur is basically a centaur beast man. you know, I think that's a pretty solid guess. There's some figures out there that already exist for them. I will say when I first saw the Beast Grave name, I like my mind jumped to Bonesplitters, the orcs. That I don't know that any of those silhouettes actually match that very well, but that you know they're a orc tribe that hunts beasts and like you know uses their bones for extra power, and so I thought that'd be something cool that might fit with whatever this is. So that. That seemed where the only other thing I thought is I've seen some suggestions that the that one silhouette that we've been describing as a beastman that it looks like maybe it could be a horned helmet, so there might be some room out there for it to be some sort of chaos helmet or something like that. So sure, another possibility sure. out there, but we shall see. I know I was pumped for this teaser, and they pretty much did exactly what it says on the tin, and they teased.
They sure did. It's about all they did.
Yeah. Tell me, gentlemen, I'll go back to you, Jeff, right off the bat. We know we're getting season 3. We know that it's called Beast Grave. We've talked about the silhouettes. That's about all we know at this point, other than we saw a picture of a lion. But Jeff, what are your hopes for Beast Grave? What are your hopes for season 3 of Warhammer Underworld?
I think my hopes, or at least the things that I'm looking forward to, is the fact that they have now left the Mirrored City. I think that they're going to this area that seems forested, seems like it's going to be a more colorful area. The boards were starting to get a little samey to me. I had 12 different sides, and if it wasn't for the lethal hexes and the red squares, I wouldn't be able to tell them apart. So to potentially be going to a new board system where the boards might have more color, maybe grass, maybe who knows what the background might be. To me, that's really exciting. I think that's going to help just change up the aesthetic of the game. That's number one for me that I'm very excited for. And then also the fact that they're out of the Shade Glass City is that the trophy kits are going to be now different. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of exciting to think that this the Q4 tournament box that's being delivered right now out to kind of all the different friendly local game stores and Games Workshop, that this is going to be everybody's last chance to get a piece of glass. Because now that they're no longer in the Mirrored City, we're now going to be out in a location that who knows what the trophy is going to look like. It won't make sense anymore for it to be a piece of Shade Glass. So what will it be?
Did not even think about that. Like, is this your last chance at glass? Ooh.
Yeah. Right. Like, what are they going to be saying now? This is your first chance at wood? I don't know. Is it going to be some sort of beast? Is it a big tooth?
Oh, would it be like a fake piece of bone or something like that? Like, oh.
Yeah. Oh, like, who knows? Right, it's just exciting. It's exciting. But this is going to be from like a history standpoint. This is going to be your last chance to get what will one day be. You're going to look back in time and say, oh, you had a glass? Yeah. I won in Q4 of season 2. So get out there and get active. If you don't go to tournaments, this is your chance. It's usually a great time. It's going to be either a best of one series or it's going to be 3 best of 3s, and go ahead and have some fun.
Sure. Phil, how about you? Anything that you're really excited for about Beast Grave?
Just more warbands, I think. So it felt like the design team sort of really hit their stride with Nightfall in getting sort of what they wanted in a warband. And so I'm excited to see what they've got going next, because I think they now know sort of the range of things they can do and where to slot new stuff in. And given that we're going to be in the realm of beasts, I'm hoping that we get a lot more destruction and stuff that's maybe a little bit different than what we've been seeing. So maybe some like ogres and, you know, just like maybe warbands that just sort of tilt the expectation of what a warband is a little bit. Because like, so say Centaurs, say it is Centaurs. Are they all going to be like move 6 base or something? Because they're all fast horses. I don't know, but it'd be sweet to see that sort of shift in where they go with mechanics and stuff.
Sure. Yeah. For myself, I would just say I hope they really lean into this idea of like this name, Beast Grave. Jeff, I think you were 100% on with like it being cool that when I first realized that Warhammer Underworlds, Shadespire, that the two things were two different things, right? Like Warhammer Underworlds was like the generic thing, and Shadespire was like a season name. I assumed that they would leave Shadespire, and I was almost surprised when they stayed in Night Vault. I thought we'd go somewhere else, and so I wasn't 100% sure like how long it would take us to actually leave the city of Shadespire. And so I'm excited for us to leave Shadespire, and 100% what you said, see some kind of new boards, see what that art brings, and on a broader perspective, like see what the overall thematic thing is. But at the same time, they brought some with them, because in that video, right, they talked about like there's a voice, it sounds heroic. You assume that it is some sort of, if I had to guess, they're trying to do the voice of some Stormcast individual. They talk about leaving the city of Shadespire through some split in reality, but they brought the Curse of the Cataphranes with them. And so what does that mean? And I'm assuming, and I did not actually draw this conclusion myself, I'm going to give a shout out to Eric from the Mortal Realms, who suggested that it might be that sort of that curse of like being reborn after dying again and again and again, which they were stuck doing in Shadespire, that is how they explain how they continue to do that once they get out of Shadespire and now are in wherever the Beast Grave is. And Phil has mentioned that he said Gur a couple times. That if folks who don't know, that's Ghur, that is the realm of beasts. That's one of the eight mortal realms. So I'm excited for the new aesthetic and what new overall theme that this might bring now that we're in a different area. So that's what we're excited for. Anything that we're expecting to see or hoping to see in this, Jeff, you got anything?
Yeah, I think this is an opportunity, because I think we can all agree that season one was something that they put together. I don't think they knew how explosive its popularity would be. And then they really quickly started working on season two. And they had some design constraints during season one. And I just feel like they've designed season two with season three in mind. So I think what we're going to see in season three is a very cohesive rules package. And what I'd love to see in that is reaction windows. I'm sure they've heard that from the community about 100 times now is sure. Can you please clarify reaction windows? So I'm expecting to see that in the season three rulebook. And I also would hope that they would take what has now become about a 20-page designer commentary where they clarify things. And maybe they can shrink that down to 5 pages or 10 pages by including some of those items again in the base rulebook. Because I think that makes it simple for new players. Where they pick up the box, they're expecting to understand how to play the game right there in the core rules, and then they have to go to, you know, 3 different websites to find the PDF for designer commentary from season two, for example. Because I think I remember during season one to season two, didn't the designer commentary get kind of thrown out and a new one got put forward? Does anybody remember that? And there was some context about it was in the last designer commentary, not the new one, and
yeah, things like that. I'm trying to think, because you're right. There was something about the errata or the FAQ that did not, where they went from one to the other, and it didn't. There's something that didn't sustain between seasons. But
yeah, so I'm kind of hoping they're going to clear that part up. I just feel like they've season three is going to be their best season yet, just because of all the lessons they learned in season two. And I guess the next thing I'd love to see is hex mechanics. I think the lethal hexes that came out at the very end of season one, at the beginning, nobody knew what they were for. Like, why would you ever want to use a board with lethal hexes?
Yeah,
and then season two comes out and you're like, oh, wow, this is a really important thing. And now you see calculated risk. I think it's very easy to look at release and wonder what's going on. But it's important to know that by the time you even see the first box, they've already thought of everything. So you gotta keep in mind that they've got a greater plan. You gotta kind of just believe that if you're going to see at the beginning of this box that you're going to see healing hexes or difficult terrain hexes, and you're wondering why would you ever want to play with those? You know, I think that's the type of mechanics that I would really love to see them continue to evolve with. Because season one had no lethals, season two had lethals. I'd love to see season three have kind of another thing, just because it makes the game really dynamic, freshens it up.
Absolutely. I think if I was to put my hopes in for Beast Grave, that would be the core thing, is that they continue to find a way to keep it fresh. I think this game thrives when the meta is in flux and when nobody's quite sure what quote-unquote the best deck to build is. And there's always people attempting to innovate, and there's always fun areas and avenues to explore. But I think it's at its best when on a grand scale things are in flux. And I think they can do that by continuing to find ways to innovate. And I hope they continue. That's my hope, is that they continue to find ways to do that. Phil, what you got any hopes for Beastgrave here?
Yeah. So sort of go along with like clarifying, you know, certain things like reaction windows, maybe rather than maybe adding some rules, but just to revisit some older ones that, you know, maybe just tighten up some language and maybe add some things to help bolster parts of the game that are sort of lacking a little bit, because like I feel like objective play right now is not in a great place, at least in the current meta, and I feel like there could be some additional changes to the rules to just maybe make it a little bit better, like the board roll off in best of three rounds. Like if you get and of course the new rule for not being able to use the same boards twice helps, but I feel like maybe they could go a little bit further, just so that like if you are playing objectives, you at least have a chance of getting that choice of like, I want the three objective hexes instead of choosing the board orientation, you know, or, you know, just something like that. Small tweaks. I don't think the game needs to change a lot. I actually would almost hope they don't add like a whole new mechanic to the game. Like, I think hex mechanics are fine because it's pretty small and you can pick up on it pretty quickly. But, like, adding magic to the game was a big deal. And I think it was, for a long time, it was almost just confusing as to, like, well, why is this here? It doesn't really seem to work very well. And then it sort of finally came to its fruition once we had all the cards. And then it became this big sort of deal of, like, oh, man, people have sort of cracked this magic thing and all of a sudden it's this huge problem. And like, I feel like the more rules you stack onto a system, the more complicated it gets and the harder to rein it in it gets. And so I'd almost hope that there's just very small tweaks going forward and that we don't see whole, you know, big ratcheted on mechanics anymore. Cause I feel like it'll make things a lot swingier and we'll need more FAQs to keep everything in line.
That's fair. So Phil, that it feels a little bit like a combination of something that you're hoping for and something that you're like a fear of it. So I am going to take that. We have anything that we're worried about? Like, is there anything that you are any fears for Beastgrave? Phil, you got anything to add? What you already have, or is it you think that represents it pretty well?
I think more, if I was going to like voice a concern more, it would be that like that they don't do enough to continue to have the, you know, card base support all the warbands. And sort of by that, I mean, like currently, I think there's some concern that certain season one warbands have kind of been left behind. And to what degree that is true or not, I'm not 100% sure. There's varying opinions, but I think it at least is a potential problem in that, you know, we saw a lot of cards come out in season two for range and for magic, and obviously nothing in season one can use any of those cards really. I mean, yeah, Farstriders, but to the same degree that, you know, like Profiteers can, it's not quite the same. And I think it adds to the sense of power creep, which I don't personally think is really a problem. I think there's plenty of really strong season one warbands, but I think that some of the arguments are valid. I think people who are trying to play orcs are having a tough time, and it's, you know, they could be helped along by adding some cards that are better for them that maybe could be in the universals going forward.
Sure. How about you, Jeff? You got anything that you're a fear that you would say, like with Beastgrave coming on?
Yeah, I think my biggest fear, and maybe it comes from my Magic background, just because, no, sorry, not Magic as in the show and tell type thing, but Magic the card game. My Magic background is that I used to play Modern, and what would happen is that every time there was new card releases, the bigger and bigger the card pool got, the less and less things would change. So it started off that, you know, things would change a lot when there was a few cards. And then you reach this point where eventually, you know, they add another 300 cards in, but you already know what your best cards are. And there might only be one card in that whatever that changes anything. So that's my concern, is that we're going to be getting pretty close to 1,000 cards here of universals. I think, you know, this might be 250 or 300 per season. So by the end of the season, we're going to be near 1,000. And are we going to start losing Warband identity? Are we going to start seeing that Cursebreakers are still playing the same way they do now at the end of next season, because they already have their best 12, their best upgrades. And so what are they going to do now? They're not going to, they might cherry pick one or two, but they still want those innates. They still want to score a glory when they cast a spell. Like, some of those things just aren't going to change. So that's my concern, is that as we continue to move through the seasons here, 3, 4, 5, and I'm sure they've already thought about this, but you know, what is the Warbands going to look like? That's my concern.
I hear you. So you're saying, like, how good does a card have to be to displace Ready for Action, right? Like, because that is going to be sitting in people's decks forever, theoretically.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's maybe a testament to where Season 1 Warbands are going to start catching up, is that Season 2 Warbands are not going to want as many of the good cards in Season 3. And eventually, the difference between the decks is going to start to become less and less, because once every card is good, you know, you can't keep picking new cards. They're not going to go to 14, 15, 16 ploys. They're going to still say at 10 or 11, and those are going to be their best 10 or 11. And the other Warbands are just starting to start picking up, getting rid of those cards that are not as useful. They're going to pick them up, and now Skeletons all of a sudden have, you know, 3 or 4 ways to cross the board quickly, because there's more Astral Wings type cards that nobody else would take. Cursebreakers aren't going to take those cards, for example.
Sure, right. That's kind of our take on our limited glimpse at what we see of Season 3.
Do you want to have, like, some wild speculation of other Warbands we think might be coming in sure. this Season 2? Right.
Well, Phil, since you brought that off, wild speculation phase, go, no judgment zone. Phil, what do you think is our wild speculation for Warbands?
Well, given the other AOS releases that were talked about at the open day, I'd be surprised if we don't see Ogres. And then I'd really like to see a, like, Free People's amalgam of, like, Dwarves, Elves, and Humans as a Warband. I think that'd be sweet. They'd be probably the most diverse Warband, and I think that could be really fun. Hopefully we'd see either Nurgle or Slaanesh or both, because, I mean, we got Tzeentch, we've got multiple Khorne. Let's round that out. And then I think we're probably going to see some Stormcast, maybe some Elves. I mean, I think that some of those are fairly obvious, but I mean, I think all of those could be very entertaining to see come into the game.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess mine, I feel like they're running out of road for Stormcast, and maybe I'm underestimating their ability to put more Stormcast into the game. But between three of them already, and also Dreadfane, which will make 4, that seems like a lot. But maybe they'll figure it out.
Hey. Primaris Stormcast, come on.
Sure. I feel like with Beastgrave, like, maybe Seraphon have, like, enough of a beast theme that they might show up.
Don't get my hopes up.
Yeah, I mean, I'll get them up just to crush them. I'm super happy to do that. But I guess I feel like Slaanesh has got to be in there. It feels like that's coming up in the storyline. I don't know how you have that in the main AOS sort of storyline and then don't also include it in the Underworlds time frame. So I guess that would be my guess, is like a rogue. Somehow they get more Stormcast in there. We see Seraphon and we see Slaanesh. Be my guesses. How about you, Jeff? You got any? And this is the wild speculation. No one will judge you except our thousands upon thousands of listeners.
Yeah, just don't give them my email address. Yeah, so I'm thinking there's probably going to be undead. I think overall they've done a good job each season of kind of having a bit of a balance between the four different army types. So I'm thinking they're probably going to have some form of undead, but everything else I agree with you there. But after seeing Warcry, and we don't need to go into a Warcry tangent, but
or the models
are just, or do we? So what I look at that, I see those models and they are incredible. If there is any amount of modeling expertise that's gone into season three models that has anything to do with Warcry, I think we're all going to be very happy. So I'm just very, very excited for these releases. I know there's a difference between push fit technology and sprue tech, but I'm just really, really excited for what we could be getting.
Yeah, if the Corvus Cabal was a warband, I would be on them for the rest of my life. Like, those. all right, so that is our take on Beastgrave. And like we said, we think this is a good opportunity to take a look back at what brought us all the way up to Beastgrave, and that would be Nightfall. So I'm going to give us, in a similar vein to our last episode, we're going to run through some questions. We're each going to answer them to the best of our ability, what our take on understanding of the Night Vault that just came through, Season 2. So we're going to do a little bit of roundtable. Jeff, we're going to start it off with you. We're going to give you a softball right off the bat. What is your favorite Night Vault warband and why?
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with Godsworn. And,
you dirty dog.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. I'm going to say Godsworn, and I think it's the same reason I just love Skaven. They're fast, and everyone can be a threat. And I think that's a lot of their backstory as well, is that they're all just searching for glory. And same with Skaven. They just they want to be recognized. And so there's a part of that model line that I just felt was a lot more. You could connect to it a lot more than other ones. So I knew all the characters' names. Every time somebody, if it was Allo, it didn't matter. If somebody did something, it was exciting because I felt like the characters were really well done. And the warband itself just was a treat to play, win or lose. So I think that's, for me, why Godsworn was my favorite warband in Nightfall.
I salute your choice, and I support it full-heartedly. For me, if I am going to pick something other than Godsworn, which I really want to pick. I would say Zarbag's Gits. I thought it was cool. They came up with a way to have a warband that was more than the number of starting hexes and plays in such a different way than any other warband. I thought that was a really innovative way to put something together, and I really like when they can come up with something new, so hats off to them. But really, I mean, Godsworn.
Well, you got to give them credit. That scatter token was almost, they used it for a few spells, but that was clearly for the Fanatic.
And
I think that's, incredible design right there.
Yeah. Phil, if your choice isn't Godsworn or Zarbags, what is your choice?
My choice is Eyes of the Nine, which I know not a lot of people give them much love, but I just think they're super fun from the sense that they're like, there's this headspace that you have to go to think about how to play them that's just totally different than anything else because they're so fragile. And yet they have sort of this weird mix of ranged and melee and hard hitting and total garbage from Tirash.
I hear you, because I've played against them where I am terrified of Vortimus, and I've played against them where Kacharik just like owns everything that I have, and I'm like, what? How do I stop this guy? Like, he's just not ever missing and killing everything. So, yeah.
But the true, I think the true like shining
example
in there is the Blue Horror, and being able to represent the splitting in the game is great. And it explores this new design space of what do you do with a fighter that doesn't inspire, but when you kill it, it doesn't actually die. And like being able to summon him anywhere on the board, that's obviously super flexible. So it just opens up all these new possibilities that no other fighter can do. So I mean, he's not quite as good as he could be because he can't take weapon upgrades, but I think if he could, he might be a little too good. So sure. Maybe that's okay. But I just think that they're a lot of fun to think about and try and figure out their puzzle.
I mean, I feel like the games against Eyes of the Nine that I find the most challenging are the games in which the other player most heavily leverages the Blue Horror / Brimstone. And those are the games where I'm like really tactically frustrated, is where they find ways to do creative things with that horror.
Yeah, he's essentially the first endless spell kind of mechanic. You know, it'd be very interesting in season 3 to see kind of more like that. Maybe something that you create that stays, kind of those persistent ploys or those persistent effects that they kind of sprinkled some breadcrumbs on during season 2 that we never really saw come to anything. You know, we got these destroy persistent ploys, but there are none. So it would be interesting if the Blue Horror was just the first of many. It's exciting. I agree with you, Phil.
That is an excellent parallel. And talking about that, I don't know, that like the persistent effects and things that we've gotten a glimpse of, I think that's an interesting take. Like, look at the things that you thought were cool that seemed experimental in season 2 and see if they expand on them in season 3. All right,
yeah.
Here is a much more specific one. Give me your favorite Night Vault card, and I'm going to start with Jeff. Go.
Actually, I'm going to choose two here because I'm a cheater. I'm going to go with Bag of Tricks and Tomb of Insight. I thought those cards, even though I didn't play them, I thought they were extremely unique, and I'm all about design space. And when I see two cards, one that lets you go into your deck and find a card, and one card that lets you look at your opponent's hand, I think those are nowhere else in the game, and there's a lot of power in knowing what your opponent has. I think those two cards to me stood out as the most unique and therefore my favorite cards in Night Vault.
I think those are great picks. I included both those cards in the ATC deck that I built where I was doing a Tomes Molag. I will say I never triggered Tome of Insight, and I triggered Bag of Tricks in absolutely crucial moments. It like secured me victory in, I'm going to say, at least 3 of the 10 games that I played over the course of the ATC, or like cemented an already, you know, good situation. So yeah, and I think to further your point, I think Bag of Tricks was very well designed because it has that search mechanic, but taking an action out of your 12. Or I should say an activation out of your 12 activations, that's a heavy cost and a charge token. Like, I just think it's an extremely well-designed deck, and I salute you for picking it. So, well done, Jeff.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'll take it.
Yeah. Phil, throw it at me. What's your favorite Night Vault card?
So I think Keep Them Guessing has been my favorite card to play with because it gives you this almost like mini game that you have to do inside your game where both as the person playing it and as the person playing against it, you have to be like, what are they doing? Like, okay, they go on guard, they moved, they did the, and then you're like, oh, maybe they're trying to do Keep Them Guessing. Is there a way I can stop them from getting like the last charge or attack that they need or something? And I just like the sort of headspace that can put you in, because it suddenly becomes less of a like, I'm going to be getting attacked or running forward and charging, to like there's a specific set of things they are trying to do, and now there's this sort of cat and mouse of trying to stop that. So I really liked that one. And then just as a general thing in season 2 overall, I just thought tomes were a great choice in how they like added another way to do something like relics, but it wasn't broken. Like, well, it's not entirely broken.
Yeah.
there are some situations that we could maybe talk about, but that's another topic.
Sure. I think those are great choices. I think I've said on our last episode how I enjoyed the mini game of keep them guessing, of trying to figure out how the turn is going to play out and how you can deny that. And so I like the back and forth of how maybe the side that's trying to score it is doing suboptimal activations in order to score it versus the side that's trying to deny it is maybe taking suboptimal because they think they see keep them guessing coming. I think it's a pretty cool card. And so that was my first choice. I struggled to come up with a backup. I think I landed on Path to Glory, and that's because I like the Godsworn so much, and I think it is I think it's a well-designed card because it is clearly an extremely powerful upgrade, and it's giving you plus one wound and plus one dice. And almost every other upgrade that gives you plus one dice is has some downside. You know, you might be talking about light armor, so now crits don't work in your defense, or it might be army of one where you have to be the last one on, or rising to the challenge where your leader is out of action. So it's really hard to get plus one dice on every attack action, and this one gives it to you just because you have another upgrade. But they figured it out is that applying upgrades in the Godsworn Warband, it is really important to be able to inspire each of those fighters. So when you're applying a second upgrade on a fighter, it means you're foregoing the option to inspire another fighter almost all the time that you play it. And so I thought it was an incredibly clever way to design a card that is very powerful, but has a restriction that is subtle enough that you don't immediately see it and say, like, oh, this is... this is a problem, and it's included in almost every, I can't say every because I, you know, obviously I'm not seeing all the crazy decks out there, but when it comes to Godsworn Hunt decks, like that is a staple, even with this clever design drawback built in. So I like it because of how powerful it is with the built-in drawback. I thought that was a great piece of design on the developer's part. So favorite cards taken care of. Talk to me about what you thought the biggest, we're gonna give you your option. You can either answer what your favorite development that you saw in Nightfall is, or what you thought the most significant change to Warhammer Underworlds was based off of the Nightfall development. And we are going to go back to Jeff. What do you got?
For me, it's probably the lethality of the power phase with magic. I thought it was a good balance in Season 1 where there was Raptor Strike, Shardgale, Aether Warden, Encroaching Shadows, because you could kind of like keep them guessing. You could kind of see them coming. They were pushing you into an edge hex, and you're kind of trying to figure out why, and it's because you knew that single damage was coming in the power phase. But with magic now, they can burn you down three, four, you know, they could one-shot you in the magic phase, or sorry, I call it the magic phase, in the power phase. And to me, that just seems like something's not right there when I don't get to roll defense dice and you're doing that much damage to me. So, especially with innates. So to me, that was a bit of a turn design-wise that I don't know if I agree with. I know it's one damage per, and now somebody's spending four of their 10 cards just to do one damage each time. So maybe that's not good on their part, but to me, that was kind of a change that I didn't really like where that was going.
Fair. Phil, what was your biggest sea change or favorite development you saw in Nightfall?
I guess I'll take this as a more significant change rather than a favorite, but it feels like the number of score immediately cards was upped quite a bit in Season 2, which meant that for a lot of decks, that meant a shift in the number of score immediately's that are being played. And I mean, there's talk of, you know, hashtag, you know, score immediately meta or whatever. And you know, you get this sort of feeling that, you know, you're somehow shifted the game entirely into score immediately's, which I don't think is true across the board, but they definitely have a higher representation than they used to. And it means that the scoring in the game is that much faster, And as we all know, every score turns into upgrades, which turns into more lethal fighters, which, you know, can mean more scoring. So I think the snowballing maybe got harder, and I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, but it means that so there's sort of this arms race now. I don't know. I'd like to see it start to swing back the other way by having enough of an incentive for score in the end phase cards to be better, or at least good enough that you would say, well, I'm just going to do something else because I can score it during the round.
Yeah, I hear you there. And I think I think what like triggers on that is with the score immediately is like emphasizes like overly how your power deck or not your power, how your objective deck draws. So like if you,
yeah.
I think the game is, I feel like playing this lately, I've been playing a God's Sworn Hunt deck that has a huge amount of score immediately, and it is wildly powerful if I get the right draw order, which I can't control. And if it comes out the wrong way, like if I draw victory after victory and opening gambit and escalation, then I got to chuck those, and that is a huge chunk of my potential glory that is thrown out. So I think that has emphasized the value in how your objective deck draws is how your score immediately has come out. You can mitigate that with how you design it, but I think it's a very valid comment on how Night Vault has impacted the game as a whole. For me, I think it was the rise of ranged attacks. At the end of Shadespire, we saw, I know in our local area, I was doing real well with my Farstriders with their ranged attacks. Night Vault brought a lot of benefits to ranged attacks, like Archer's Focus, like Glory Seeker, like anything, like Jeff was talking about. The ability to throw spells in the power phase, you are laying damage on people from 4 or even 5 hexes away, or even infinite hexes away if you're talking about something like Cry of Thunder, right? So we're talking about ways to lay damage on the other warband without as much risk to yourself. And I thought we saw an escalation of that and not a lot of mitigation. And even if you look at the warbands that came out in Night Vault, you'd be hard-pressed to come up with one that did not have a significant amount of ranged attack. If we're looking at Season 1, like Range 2 was kind of a big deal. Scritch was a big deal because he had a Range 2 attack. Farstriders are a big deal because they all had a Range 3 attack. If you look at the Season 2 warbands, everyone in there at least has some kind of range 2 or higher attack, as opposed to Season 1, where many of them are stuck all at range 1. And I think that was a huge, substantial change to the game. And it basically sidelined a bunch of cards that would only work if, you know, so something that would only work if the attacker was adjacent to you, or would only work if somebody's attacking you with a range 1 attack. Those cards, some of them are very powerful, but only, you know, we'll take a look. Let's say in the most recent, there was a Power Unbound dropped one for Molog, something Grin. I can't remember the exact name, but he would uninspire a fighter that damaged him as long as they attacked with like a range 1 attack. That's a really powerful card, except for the fact that a lot of people attacking him are not attacking with range 1 anymore. I think the fact that even a card like that is not seeing a ton of play is an example of how prevalent that ranged attacks have become. So those are the biggest changes, but let's talk about, I don't know that we would have anticipated all those, but what was something you didn't anticipate? What is your biggest surprise from Night Vault? And we're going to circle back ahead. Phil, why don't you throw us at your biggest surprise from Night Vault?
So So I guess not necessarily in terms of a mechanics surprise, but in terms of a maybe a reaction to the mechanics. But so Magic, I guess, as I mentioned earlier, when it first came out, it was kind of like, well, this is, you know, nice, I guess, but it's taking up space in your power deck. And, you know, if you don't have wizards to cast those spells, they're dead cards, so it's risky. And, you know, until there were cards that were like so good that you felt that it was worth taking them, it was kind of like, well, I'm not going to do anything with Magic. But once those cards did come out, like Sphere of Akshi and Curse of the Dwindling and stuff like that, you started to see people actually take them more. And then, of course, towards the end, it seems like it's become this almost like bugaboo for the community of like, oh, you know, Magic's busted. Mostly since Power Unbound came out. And I don't know if that's necessarily true. Because it is this very high risk, high reward mechanic. And I think that really the problem wasn't the Magic itself, it was Curse Breakers. Mm. And it caused this huge reaction, but I'm, you know, coming from the perspective of all the warbands with wizards, it's like, is Zarbag a problem for having these spell cards? Absolutely not. Is Thedra a problem for having all these spell cards? In no way possible. In fact, I would guess that most Godsworn players include no spells because she's a trap. Yes. And like including Magic for her is bad. And like even Vortimus, who can get kind of strong with Magic, like he's easy enough to take out sometimes that there's a very high risk that if he gets killed right away, a lot of your deck becomes useless. Whereas with Curse Breakers, it's like, well, we'll put an 8 on all three of them. And then you have to kill all of them to make these spells not work. And so I think it had this outsized reaction. And so I was just a little surprised by the sort of the strength of people's distaste for the sort of building up of Magic, because I actually thought it was kind of nice to see Magic become a real usable mechanic.
Yeah, I feel like early on, I remember looking at Curse Breakers and being like, I don't know what these guys are going to do. Like, it doesn't seem like there's enough they can do. And people were specifically saying, like, if enough Gambit spells drop, these guys might accelerate. And obviously they did. Yeah. Jeff, biggest surprise from Night Vault. What was yours?
Yeah, I'm going to take more of a positive spin, because I do feel like I've said a few negative things in a row here. And I did really love Night Vault. And so the biggest surprise for me, I think, is going to be the shift in the community towards the competitive scene. Our local meta, we're doing a tournament, not this Tuesday, but the following Tuesday. And there's going to be like 16 people there on a Tuesday night. So it's just nice. It's just booming right now. And I think that's because of how well-designed Night Vault was. I know that there's, you know, a few war bands that that are maybe more problematic, but I think there's, I don't know if it's Wigglehammer or somebody's putting out numbers that I've seen that show that there's, you know, are the win percentages are somewhere between, you know, 38 or 40 up to 60 or 62. So we've got this 20% spread or plus or minus 10 from the center. And every time people come into the tournaments, everybody's having a great time. So I think the community is a great spot, and I'm surprised in Night Vault that continued, because in season one, we didn't see that type of tournament you know, attendance. So I'm surprised that Night Vault, that the competitive scene has grown as much as it has. So that's a positive for me that I'm surprised about.
Sure. I'm going to follow up with another positive. For me, my surprise was Godsworn, because when they dropped, everyone was like, what is this hot pile of garbage? Like, how is anybody going to win with these guys? And because they dropped alongside Molog, like he was the hotness. I felt like I was an early believer, brought him to Adepticon, did not do very well with him, thought I might be wrong, and then apparently I'm just not a very good Godsworn player, because people brought him to the most recent Warhammer World Grand Clash and did excellent with him. They were well represented in the top 16, and it's just that it's not that they're bad, it's that I'm not good with them, even though I think they can be good. as is represented the fact that, like, I after doing well at ATC, I'm barely scraping 500 with Godsworn. But I thought it was cool to see a warband that everyone dogged on, and then slowly came around to being like, oh, actually, these guys might be good. And some of that is cards that dropped after the initial assessment, but some of it is just I like the idea that there's enough depth in the game that you can discover something about a warband even after your immediate. I like thinking that everyone's snap judgment does not necessarily constitute the gospel truth of what a warband is. So big surprise, and very happy for that surprise. Jeff, I know you're trying to go positive. Give me any disappointments. Any disappointments you had with Nightfold?
Yeah, so I guess the only disappointment that was a surprise is I thought they were going to, when Power Unbound came out, support Season 1. I thought there was going to be cards in there, or warband cards for all of the older warbands too, because I was telling some friends, I said, you know what I think skeletons need? They need a cataphrane relic type card where you get, for every dead skeleton, you get a glory. Like, they need, like, we need some cards that are going to give some of these older factions ways to catch up on glory, because I think it's more on the glory side that they're suffering. And I just really, really was hopeful of that. And then when they came out and they said there's nothing for Season 1, I just really thought that was a lost opportunity or missed opportunity. They could have made that pack of cards, you know, 15, 20 cards thicker, and I don't think it would have really changed anything. So, on their perspective, it would have made a large change in the game. So that was a big surprise that they didn't take that opportunity for Power Unbound.
Yeah, you'd like to think that even just a two or three cards for a Season 1 warband would galvanize enough people to go back and look at that warband and maybe even pick it up if they hadn't already done so.
Agreed.
Yeah, I hope they revisit that. You know, you get even something like, you know, reintroduce Extreme Flank, but make it faction specific for skeletons or something like that. There's options to have those warbands catch up pretty quick and get people interested in them again. So.
Yeah, and I think if they were very targeted, just like you said there, if they were very targeted at certain warbands on what their issues are right now, like Skaven, if there was one more way to bring back a rat, if there was a second card, a boy card, my goodness, yeah. I think they'd be unstoppable. And skeletons, like you mentioned, if they had ways to use those petitioners more, or maybe get credit for when they're killed at the very end of the game, like little things like that could make a big difference.
Absolutely. Phil, how about you? Anything that you were a little on the downside from Nightfold?
Well, now that I feel like I'm the negative Nancy of the group here, I'll try to have something that's a little bit less negative. And I guess I would just say that I felt like, well, the balance, I think, is pretty good across the game in general. I think there's room to be a little bit more aggressive with the bar. I was really surprised that there was only two cards in the most recent update. I really thought that we were going to be moving quite a bit more, just so that we could move the needle a bit, right? I mean, if you look at competitive decks, there's a handful of cards that are pretty much universal, and I don't necessarily think that's a great thing for the game. If you can just know that, you know, 90% of the time you're going to see Escalation, Ready for Action, and Superior Tactician, that it's kind of like, yep, those are probably outside the bell curve, and we should probably be willing to take a little bit of a harder stance with some of those just to shake things up, right? I mean, they're not like bad cards to have in the game, but it makes things stagnant, I think.
I hear you.
So I'd like to see that pick up a little bit here, and I was a little disappointed they weren't a little more aggressive.
Sure, I've said in the past, like I would rather they. I hear you with it. I think they could have gone more aggressive. If they have to err on one side or the other, I'm glad that they err on the more conservative, like the less aggressive, because they can always step it up later if they have to.
Definitely.
For me, I would say that it felt inevitable, but once, as the number of warbands increase, it feels it's a little bit of a bummer that some warbands get left behind. So I think it's generally agreed that Gerzag is trying to find his place in the current meta, and he may be a victim of the fact that Molog is out there, and the cards that work against Molog work even better against Gerzag. I will say that with the caveat of, I think unless you're playing at the very highest level, unless you're playing at the very highest skill curve, you can probably do just fine with any of the 16 warbands out there. And if you want to find success with them, you probably can. Unless you are like really for that, top 5%. And it's just like Jeff said, like the win percentage is anywhere from, 38% to 62%. So you're really looking at, like, at the worst possible entry point, you're probably going in, a disadvantage of 2 to 3 or something like that, and that's pretty good for a competitive game. So, if that's the worst that we can come up with, then hats off. Let's talk about what was the thing that was the biggest shock to you? What was the biggest surprise in the season 2? And we'll start all the way from the very beginning. Phil, we're going to go right back at you. What did you find to be the biggest shock to you throughout the entirety of Night Vault?
It's kind of a toss up, but I'm going to say the Molog fac. I didn't see that coming, and I don't. Like, it felt like a mistake at the time to say that he can just keep activating after charging. And it still kind of feels that way to me. Like, I don't think he needs to be able to do that. I don't know. And I think it kind of shows in how much he's being played, because, like, he does have this sort of outsized power because of that. And I mean, we could argue that maybe he's not good enough if he can't do that, but like, he's still super strong. So, I don't know. I just felt like he was strong enough the way he was, and seeing him fact to be like, oh yeah, he just gets to activate 4 times a turn. No big deal. that was sort of strange. It also had some probably unintended consequences, like Tome of Glories being able to be activated multiple times, and some stuff like that that they probably didn't think about. Some interesting stuff with that.
Sure. For me, I can distinctly remember my biggest shock was opening up. I'm going to throw it wrong here, but opening up my Godsworn Hunt package and looking at Tome of Offerings and being like, oh my god, like, how does this card exist? Because it already felt like a cool and unique card for the Khorne Warbands, and it was just like, JK, it exists for anybody. So I'm glad it got restricted. I was surprised how long it took to get restricted, but I was a little shocked that they set up a card like that. I can distinctly remember that being my biggest surprise during the season. Let's flip it around to something positive. What was your favorite year of any of the fighters released during the?
Are we gonna get Jeff's shock?
Oh, I'm sorry, Jeff. I missed that. Oh. Jeff, what was your biggest shock from Night Vault?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Actually, sometimes, because I've been listening to you guys for so long, sometimes I forget that I'm actually on the show. And it just feels like any other Wednesday on my way to work. So, no, it's okay. I zoned out there too. I'd say Accolade of the Cataphranes. After the season 1 relics issues, I kind of didn't think they would approach another way for there to be, a way to score, 6, 7, 8 glory at the end of the game. And so when Acolytes came out in, I think it might have been Eyes, there was only 2 or 3 tomes at that point, and then maybe there was 4. And then all of a sudden now there's, I think it's 7 or 8. And I just think that they really could have probably capped that at 5. And it would have been a card that scores maybe 3 at the end, maybe 4, 5 if you're using Bag of Tricks. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you can get it up so high, I think it's going to be problematic. Maybe not now. Maybe it's season 3, season 4. At some point, I think they're going to have to come back and address it.
Sure. I agree. I think they made a valiant effort on designing that, because a number of those tomes feel like really like, why, what am I doing with this thing? Running Tomes Molog, I got some mileage out of Tome of Healing. I got some mileage out of Tome of Warfare, but it was very situational. A lot of times it was just like, I'm throwing this on. But it was, in effect, a formless key, or, you know, whatever, I should say, a destiny to meet or something like that. Like, I'm throwing this on, it's going to be glory at the end of the game. And that is a card that's restricted anyway. So I totally see where you're coming from. I think it was a valiant effort. And I'd be interested to see how they attempt to address it moving forward. But
yeah, because I don't think it's broken per se. The shock is just that they did it. It's not so much shock as in it's not good. Because as you mentioned, the round you pull up your hand and you've got four cataphranes in it in your opening grip, like you'd essentially lost at that point.
Yeah.
So because you can't ditch them. That's the total of your plan is to get all those on. You can't just get rid of four of the six of them. So I think there's risk and reward with running that many. I'm just amazed that they took the chance to build it that way.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because Mark Cooper dropped me a line and said, I don't know if he's thinking of running or something. He's like, hey, what would you do if you drew, and the deck I was running specifically only ran six tomes because I couldn't take the magic specific tome and I had to give Tome of Offerings up to one of my teammates. And he said, what would you do if you drew five tomes? I was like, man, I'm glad I never had to make that decision because that sounds awful. I'd write that round off, I guess. But yeah, so that's a great choice. Let's bring it back. All right, so favorite fighter. And Jeff, since I forgot you last round, let's go right back at you. What was your favorite fighter from Night Vault?
Yeah, I was going to say Skaven, but you said Night Vault. I'm going to go with probably Molog. Was my favorite. Oh, sorry, favorite fighter. I was going to say Skaven. So yeah, I guess I can't say Scritch here. So I'm going to say Briar Queen.
Sure.
I think she just had the biggest toolkit of any of the leaders from the set.
Definitely would agree.
Yeah, and that's kind of a low key choice. Like I don't think it's obvious at the outset, but I think that's 100% a real good option. And I think it's demonstrated well by players like Team Bills, who are taking a build that is purely objective. So you'd think that your leader didn't matter much, and he gets a lot of mileage out of her as far as like cleaning up, like clearing off threats to his warband and all that sort of thing. So yeah, great choice. Phil, let me with your favorite fighter is.
Well, I've kind of already talked about him, but the Blue Horror.
Nice.
I really like the design space, and I've had a lot of fun with using him. I got a soft spot for the little blue guy.
Sure. I think anybody who's got a high skill ceiling on him is a pretty fun fighter to look at. And I think the Blue Horror matches that description, right? Like on first glance, you're like, what is this guy even supposed to do? But as you get more practice, you can get more and more out of them. So, as far as I go, I have said multiple times on record, Ollo for president. to that effect, I lost the deciding game for Shade Glass today off of Ollo, except it was a mirror match Ollo. So, I think my Ollo was already dead. His Ollo had literally 8 upgrades on him, which
oh my God,
was ridiculous. And I could not run away fast enough, and I died. So that on the one side, but also Snurk for just being such a unique fighter having the ability. If you can get Snurk in there and score the kill and obliterated, you've just inspired your warband off of the one action, and that is pretty great. He's a weird oddball, and I really appreciate his presence in the game and how he can represent like a almost a mini game within the game of playing against Gitz.
Definitely.
All right, I think we're on to coming out of Night Vault, and if we're trying to judge the competitive meta, what would you rate your top three warbands as? And let's see, Jeff, I'm going to throw it your way here. If you thought you had to pick what you thought the most competitive three warbands were coming out of Nightfall, what would you say?
Yeah, I'd say it's some combination because I think they're really close, but it's Molog, Profiteers, and Cursebreakers. I think those are the top three right now.
Mm, yeah. How about you, Phil? What do you got?
I'd agree on Molog and Cursebreakers. I think it becomes a really weird mix after that, though. And it's really hard to say. Like, there's a part of me that wants to say it's Guardians, but they do have some pretty significant weaknesses. Profiteers, again, it's, you know, they have their strengths, but they have their weaknesses too. So it's sort of this mix. And I mean, honestly, after seeing like the Fester and Hunger deck build from Mad Skulls, it was kind of like
Mad Skulls.
Maybe Skaven. I don't know if anybody's actually run it at a Grand Clash yet. So, I don't know. We'll have to see. But it feels like a kind of deck that I don't think many people would be ready for. So, I think there's still some room for improvisation and figuring out where that sort of jockeying of the podium goes once you're past Molag and Cursebreakers that I think are outside the curve right now.
Yeah,
though I think a caveat that I want to point out is that those two warbands, although they're outside the curve, are not broken. They're not beating everyone. Mm-hmm. You can beat them. Cursebreakers and Molag both only have like one Grand Clash win each. So it's not like they're always sweeping. You know, it's this mix. So, you know, Briar Queen is up there, and you've got, you know, LVO was won by Magors, and so it's sort of, and I know there was a lot fewer cards for that, but still, you know, Molag only just recently got their first Grand Clash win, so let's not take too much stock in the sort of meta rankings.
Sure. That is a good point. We're taking this all with a grain of salt. Speaking of grain of salt, I put my top three as Molag, Molag, Molag.
Is that just because you won 5 games in a row?
Yeah, matches, sir. Matches.
Well, ten games.
I mean, and to caveat that, it was our team was designed to put me into favorable matchups and give me the easier win, so we could secure one of the three matches a win and hope one of the other two guys could dig it out. But honestly, I think I'm going to go with Molag, Guardians, and Profiteers, and I think Guardians and Profiteers have a very high skill ceiling on them. I think the places you can get with, and this is specifically with respect to the most recent Bandit Restricted list and the errata and such, changing the rules such that spells need line of sight. I think that bumped Cursebreakers down just enough to bump these other two up. Guardians and Profiteers, I think if you're coming into them without as much practice, I think you may struggle more. But I think with enough practice, they get really really high up there. And I think Molag, just on the back of the ability to go tomes, like a defensive build or all-out aggressive, I think he's always in the conversation for one of the top three. So that would be my top three. But I totally agree with Phil, where I think the meta's in a pretty healthy place. I think that player skill dictates a lot of how well you're going to do. I think my other choice for the top three is whatever the three most recent that Michael Carlin has built a weird deck for, because apparently that's gonna be the hotness. So
yeah,
and I think there's a place too for Godsworn, and I know we were joking around about it earlier, but that most recent Grand Clash, there was two or three
in the top 16, which is
and I think piloted by some of the best players in the world, like I think John Rees, and like there was some really great players playing them, and I don't think they were playing them because they wanted to make a statement. I think they were playing them because they honestly thought they had the tools to take down some of these other contenders, and they did. It's too bad they didn't pull it out in day two, and I'm very happy they're doing day twos now.
Sure.
But I think how we're ending Nightfault as a season, there it is really neck and neck for 6 of the 8 warbands. And I think if I was designing the game, if I had 6 of 8 war bands that are contending, I've done my job. So sure. I'm really happy with that.
Absolutely.
It's all good.
Speaking of ending Night Vault, here's a question that I haven't prepped you guys for at all. Tell me, what is your overall take? Like, how do you feel like the health of the game is? And you can give me a rating from 1 to 10, or you can just give me your verbal, give me your qualitative instead of your quantitative. Where do you think, how do you feel about the state of the game at this point? as we're about to enter Beast Grave. Phil, lead us off.
Yeah. So this game, when it first came out, it just seemed like sort of a fun, you know, quick thing that I could just pick up and go with and have a few fun games to sort of be a side thing with Age of Sigmar, because Age of Sigmar games take quite a bit longer. It has grown into something that always keeps pulling me back, and like I can play this game almost unendingly, and it's become probably my favorite tabletop game that I've ever played. Mm-hmm. And I've played quite a few, and I think that is a testament to the rule set and the flexibility, and like having this, I think, probably pretty unique combination of deck building and skirmish type miniature gaming that I don't think has been done before. And I feel like it's being executed at a very high level. There's no sort of lax rule writing to, or at least that I can sort of put a finger on. And I think that means that there's a ton of room for creativity, and it's just generally a fun game to play. And so I'm super happy with it. And despite some of the, you know, complaints, I'd still say that I only complain from a place of love, and that I just want to see the game be even better than it already is.
Yeah. I'm with Phil. If I was going to give my state after Night Vault, I'm impressed with the warbands they did with Night Vault. I think a good indicator of how much I enjoy the game is that every time I'm playing against another warband, I'm like, huh, that warband looks pretty fun to play. Like, maybe I can come over and deck with them. And that's cool, right? And I think what we occasionally undervalue in this game is like how cool the figs are. Like, you, it would be one thing if we were just playing with tokens and numbers and, you know, it was just like spreadsheets against spreadsheets, but it's not. It's some really cool figures, even the cards have art and all that sort of thing. Like I think as a complete package, I've been greatly enjoying it. I think they've done great things with it. I think a good indicator, Phil, is like you and I just finished a little small mini tournament today. We got done each with three matches, and our first instinct after finishing three matches was that you and I played another game of it. So yep. I think that's a pretty good, good.
Definitely in a good space.
Yeah, exactly. What about you, Jeff? Is that sounds like maybe your take as well?
Yeah, that's definitely my take. I don't think the game's ever been more healthy, and I think it's going to keep attracting more players from other games. I grew up playing a lot of chess and Magic, and those are clearly very tight rule sets. And when you go to a tournament, there's just something nice knowing that you've got a good rule set that's going to make sure that there's no issues and everybody's going to have fun. I play a lot of 40K competitively, and there's always this issue when you're on the table about trying to make sure that the other person's not cheating. Are they stealing inches? Are they scooping dice? Like what could they be doing that might not level the playing field? And Underworlds just seems to have taken that right out of play. The games are quick. They're tight. You're able to play at a really high level of positioning, dice, deck building. It just seems to have everything. And I think the more seasons it goes, the more players from other genres are going to start coming to this and saying, you know what, I can dive into this competitively where I would be afraid to dive into 40K and AOS where I might get bullied at the table. So I think this game is in a really, really great place, and kudos to the designers, and also kudos to all the content providers like yourselves and all the podcasts and blogs, because I think the community is just so positive, and it's grown more and more positive and bigger for Night Vault than it did in season one. And I think that's because everyone's really excited. And I think that's a great thing.
Absolutely. I think that about brings us to the end of this episode. I'm glad we got a little glimpse at Beast Grave. It gave us the opportunity to take a look about everything that Night Vault gave us. We are going to close things out here. If you want to get in touch with us, if you think we're totally off base, if you want to give your contribution for answering any of the questions we did today, you can let us know at WTHcast, that's on Twitter, or whattheheckscast@gmail.com. If you want to look at any of our content for the broader Mortal Realms network, you can go to themortalrealms.com. We're always appreciative for any of the reviews that are dropped to us. It helps us out more than you realize. Actually, Jeff, I should have said, if people want to get in touch with you, if they want to hit you up with anything, tell you that you were spot on with all your analysis and that you should come back for every episode that you could, where's the best place for people to give you a shout out?
Yeah. I'm not actually very social media savvy, so I'm definitely on Facebook. I'm always around the Underworld's Facebook group, but aside from that, I really don't have too much of a social media presence. I just love to consume media, just probably like all your other listeners. So that's where they can find me.
All right, fair enough. And if you want to get at him, you're welcome to hit us up, and we'll pass it on to Jeff. As always, we got some recommended listening coming at you. I am going to recommend, let's say, The Night Descending by Iron and Wine. That's off of our Endless Number Days. And Phil, you're going to close us out with the follow-up here. We got a second recommended listening.
Yeah, and I'm going to recommend Beast in Black by Beast in Black if you're into some campy power metal.
And who isn't? So,
of course.
Thank you all for listening. We're going to come back at you in 2 weeks' time. We hope to be coming at you with a little bit of information on Warhammer Underworlds Online. So if you've got anything that you want to know about that game, hit us up with your questions. We're going to pass those on to the developers. In the meantime, for What the Hex, I've been Davey.
This is Phil.
This is Jeff.
Ideal is that I'm going to whip this up, get it edited, and it's going to drop in just a little bit more than 24 hours, actually. So,
it's incredible.
Yeah. Well, wait until it actually happens.
That's the plan.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say it's probably going to take you at least that long to cut out all the my clips of my voice throughout. So.